It was loaded with a tangle of rusted-out junk. Washing machines, tumble dryers, bicycle frames, bent rebar, road sign posts all folded and looped out of shape by accidents. The truck thundered by with its exhaust cackling on the overrun as it coasted through the bend. Then it was gone, in a long tail of battered air and dancing dust. 10 minutes later, a second truck blew by, an identical flatbed doing 60 from Montana, heaped with wrecked cars. Its tires whined loud, and Vaughn woke up and glanced ahead at it and asked,
"How's your theory doing?"
Reacher said, "Nothing to support it yet, but also nothing to disprove it."
"Good morning."
"To you, too."
"Sleep long?"
"Long enough." The next truck was also heading east, an ugly 10-wheel army vehicle with two guys in the cab and a green box on the back, a standardized NATO payload hauler built in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, and about as pretty as an old pair of dungarees. It wasn't small, but it was smaller than the preceding semis, and it was slower. It barreled through the curve at about 50 miles an hour and left less of a turbulent wake. "Resupply," Reacher said, "for the MP base. Beans, bullets, and bandages. Probably from Carson."
"Does that help?"
"It helps the MPs. The beans, anyway. I don't suppose they're using many bullets or bandages."
"I meant, does it help with your theory?"
"No." Next up was a semi coming west, out of despair. The bed was loaded with steel bars, a dense, heavy load. The tractor unit's engine was roaring. The exhaust note was a deep bellow, and black smoke was pouring from the stack. Vaughn said,
"One of the four we saw last night."
Reacher nodded. "The other three will be right behind it. The business day has started."
"By now they know we broke into that container."
"They know somebody did."
"What will they do about it?"
"Nothing." The second of the outgoing semis appeared on the horizon, then the third. Before the fourth showed up, another incoming truck blew by, a container truck, a blue China Lines container on it, heavy by the way the tires stressed and whined. New Jersey plates. Vaughn said,
"Combat wrecks."
Reacher nodded and said nothing. The truck disappeared in the morning haze, and the fourth outgoing load passed it. Then the dust settled, and the world went quiet again. Vaughn arched her back and stretched, perfectly straight from her heels to her shoulders.
"Oh, I feel good."
"You deserve to."
"I needed you to know about David."
"You don't have to explain." Reacher was turned in his seat, watching the western horizon a mile away. He could see a small shape wobbling in the haze, a truck far away, small because of the distance, square and rigid, a box truck, tan-colored. He said, "Pay attention now." The truck took a minute to cover the mile, and then it roared past. Two axles, plain, boxy, tan paint, no logo on it, no writing of any kind. It had Canadian plates from Ontario. "Prediction," Reacher said. "We're going to see that truck heading out again within about 90 minutes.
"Why wouldn't we? It'll unload and go home."
"Unload what?"
"Whatever's in it."
"Which would be what?"
"Scrap metal."
"From where?"
"Ontario's biggest city is Toronto, so from Toronto, according to the law of averages."
Reacher nodded. "Route 401 in Canada, I-94 around Detroit, I-75 out of Toledo, I-70 all the way over here. That's a long distance."
"Relatively."
"Especially considering that Canada probably has steel mills all its own. I know for sure they're thick on the ground around Detroit and all over Indiana, which is practically next door. So why haul ass all the way out here?"
"Because Thurman's place is a specialist operation. You said so yourself."
Canada's army is 3 men and a dog. They probably keep their stuff forever.
Vaughn said, Combat Rex.
Canada isn't fighting in Iraq. Canadians had more sense.
So what was in that truck?
My guess is nothing at all. Plenty more trucks passed by in both directions, but they were all uninteresting. Semi-trailers from Nebraska, Wyoming, Utah, Washington State, and California, loaded with crushed cars and bales of crushed steel and rusted industrial hulks that might once have been boilers or locomotives or parts of ships. Reacher looked at them as they passed and then looked away. He kept his focus on the eastern horizon and the clock in his head. Vaughn got out and brought the captured file from under the mat in the trunk. She took the papers out of the cardboard cradle and turned them over and squared them on her knee, licked her thumb, and started with the oldest page first. It was dated a little less than 7 years previously. It was a purchase order for 5,000 gallons of trichloroethylene to be delivered prepaid by Kearney Chemical to Thurman Metals. The second oldest page was identical, as was the third. The fourth fell into the following calendar year. Vaughn said,
15,000 gallons in the first year, is that a lot?
I don't know. We'll have to let the state lab be the judge. The second year of orders came out the same, 15,000 gallons. Then the third year jumped way up to 5 separate orders for a total of 25,000 gallons, a refill every 70-some days, an increase in consumption of close to 67%. Vaughn said,
The start of major combat operations, the first wrecks.
The fourth year held steady at 25,000 gallons. The fifth year matched it exactly.
David's here,
Vaughn said.
His Humvee was rinsed with some of those gallons. What was left of it?
The sixth year she looked at jumped again. Total of 6 orders. Total of 30,000 gallons. Iraq, getting worse. A 20% increase. And the current year looked set to exceed even that. There were already 6 orders in, and the year still had a whole quarter to run. Then Vaughn paused and looked at the 6 pages again, one by one, side by side, and she said,
No. One of these is different.
Different how?
One of the orders isn't for trichloroethylene, and it isn't in gallons. It's in tons, for something called trinitrotoluene. Thurman bought 20 tons of it.
When?
3 months ago. Maybe they misfiled it.
From Kearney?
Yes.
Then it isn't misfiled.
Maybe it's another kind of degreaser.
It isn't.
You heard of it?
Everyone has heard of it. It was invented in 1863 in Germany for use as a yellow dye.
I never heard of it. I don't like yellow.
A few years later, they realized it decomposes in an exothermic manner.
What does that mean?
It explodes. Vaughn said nothing. Trichloroethylene is called TCE, Reacher said. Trinitrotoluene is called TNT.
I've heard of that.
Everyone has heard of it.
Thurman bought 20 tons of dynamite? Why?
Dynamite is different. It's nitroglycerin soaked into wood pulp and molded into cylinders wrapped in paper. TNT is a specific chemical compound, a yellow solid, much more stable, therefore much more useful.
Okay, but why did he buy it?
I don't know. Maybe he busts things up with it. It melts easily and pours. That's how they get it into shell casings and bombs and shaped charges. Maybe he uses it like a liquid and forces it between seams he can't cut. He was boasting to me about his advanced techniques.
I never heard any explosions.
You wouldn't. You're 20 miles from the plant. And maybe they're small and controlled.
Is it a solvent when it's liquid?
I'm not sure. It's a reagent, that's all I know. Carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, and oxygen. Some complicated formula. Lots of sixes and threes and twos.
Vaughn riffled back through the pages she had already examined. Whatever. He never bought any before. It's something new.
Reacher glanced ahead through the windshield, saw the tan box truck heading back toward them. It was less than a mile away. He took the red bubble light off the dash and held it in his hand. Stand by, he said. We're going to stop that truck.
We can't. We don't have jurisdiction here.
The driver doesn't know that. He's Canadian.
Chapter 57
Vaughn was a cop from a small, quiet town, but she handled the traffic stop beautifully. She started the car when the truck was still a quarter mile away and put it in gear. Then she waited for the truck to pass and pulled out of the old road onto the new and settled in its wake. She hung back 100 yards to be clearly visible in its mirrors. Reacher opened his window and clamped the bubble light on the roof. Vaughn hit a switch, and the light started flashing. She hit another switch, and her siren quacked twice. Nothing happened for 10 long seconds. Vaughn smiled.
"Here it comes," she said. "The who-me moment."
The truck started to slow. The driver lifted off, and the cab pitched down a degree as weight and momentum settled on the front axle. Vaughn moved up 50 yards and drifted left to the crown of the road. The truck put its turn signal on. It rolled ahead and then braked hard and aimed for a spot where the shoulder was wide. Vaughn skipped past and tucked in again, and the two vehicles came to a stop, nose to tail in the middle of nowhere, 40 miles of empty road behind them and more than that ahead. She said,
"A search would be illegal."
Reacher said, "I know. Just tell the guy to sit tight. 5 minutes. We'll wave him on when we're done."
"With what?"
"We're going to take a photograph." Vaughn got out and cop-walked to the driver's window. She spoke for a moment, then walked back. Reacher said, "Back up on the other shoulder, at right angles. We need to see the whole truck, side on, with the camera." Vaughn checked ahead and behind, and jockeyed forward and back, and then reversed across the blacktop in a wide curve, and came to rest sideways on the opposite shoulder, with the front of her car pointed dead center at the side of the truck. It was a plain, simple vehicle, a stubby hood, a cab, twin rails running back from it with a box body bolted on. The box had alloy skin and was corrugated every foot for strength and rigidity. Tan paint, no writing. Reacher said, "Camera." Vaughn hit laptop keys, and the screen lit up with a picture of the truck. Reacher said, "We need to see the thermal image." Vaughn said,
I don't know if it works in the daytime."
She hit more keys, and the screen blazed white. No detail, no definition. Everything was hot. Reacher said, "Turn down the sensitivity." She toggled keys, and the screen dimmed. Ahead, through the windshield, the real-time view stayed unchanged. But the image on the laptop screen faded to nothing, and then came back ghostly green. Vaughn played around until the road surface and the background scrub showed up as a baseline gray, barely visible. The truck itself glowed 100 shades of green. The hood was warm, with a bright center where the engine was. The exhaust pipe was a vivid line with green gases shimmering out the end in clouds. The rear differential was hot and the tires were warm. The cab was warm, a generalized green block with a slight highlight where the driver was sitting and waiting. The box body was cold at the rear. It stayed cold until it suddenly got warmer, 3/4 of the way forward. A section 5 feet long directly behind the cab was glowing bright. Reacher said, "Take it down some more." Vaughn tapped a key until the tires went gray and merged with the road. She kept on going until the grays went black, and the picture simplified to just 5 disembodied elements in just 2 shades of green. The engine? Hot. The exhaust system? Hot. The differential case? Warm. The cab? Warm. The first 5 feet of the box body? Warm. Vaughn said,
"It reminds me of the wall around the metal plant. Hotter at one end than the other."
Reacher nodded, stuck his arm out the window, waved the driver onward, and peeled the bubble light off the roof. The truck lurched as the gears caught, and it pulled across the rumble strip and got straight in the traffic lane and lumbered slowly away. First gear, then second, then third. The laptop screen showed a vivid plume of hot exhaust that swelled and swirled into a lime-green cloud before cooling and dissipating and falling away into blackness. Vaughn asked,
"What did we just see?"
"A truck on its way to Canada."
"That's all?"
"You saw what I saw."
"Is this part of your theory?"
"Pretty much all of it."
"Want to tell me about it?"
"Later."
"Then what?"
"When it's safely across the border."
"Why then?"
"Because I don't want to put you in a difficult position."
"Why would it?"
"Because you're a cop."
"Now you're trying to keep me out of trouble?"
Reacher said, "I'm trying to keep everybody out of trouble." They turned around and drove back to where the old road forked. They bumped down off the new blacktop, and this time they kept on going, between the 2 ruined farms, all the way to Halfway Township. First stop was the coffee shop for a late breakfast. Second stop was a Holiday Inn, where they rented a bland beige room and showered and made love and went to sleep. They woke up at 4 and did all the same things in reverse order, like a film run backward. They made love again, showered again, checked out of the hotel, and headed back to the coffee shop for an early dinner. By 5:30, they were on the road again, heading east, back toward despair. Vaughn drove. The setting sun was behind her, bright in her mirror. It put a glowing rectangle of light on her face. The truck route was reasonably busy in both directions. The metal plant ahead was still sucking stuff in and spitting it out again. Reacher watched the license plates. He saw representatives from all of Colorado's neighboring states, plus a container truck from New Jersey heading outward, presumably empty, and a flatbed semi from Idaho heading inward, groaning under a load of rusted steel sheet. He thought, "License plates." He said, "I was in the Gulf the first time around." Vaughn nodded.
"You wore the same BDUs every day for 8 months, in the heat, which is a delightful image. I felt bad enough putting these clothes back on."
"We spent most of the time in Saudi and Kuwait, of course, but there were a few covert trips into Iraq itself."
"And?"
"I remember their license plates being silver, but the ones we saw last night in the container were off-white."
"Maybe they changed them since then."
"Maybe. But maybe they didn't. Maybe they had other things to worry about."
"You think those weren't Iraqi cars?"
"I think Iran uses off-white plates."
"So what are you saying? We're fighting in Iran? And nobody knows? That's not possible."
"We were fighting in Cambodia in the 70s and nobody knew. But I think it's more likely there's a bunch of Iranians heading west to Iraq to join in the fun every day. Maybe like commuting to a job. Maybe we're stopping them at the border crossings with artillery."
"That's very dangerous."
"For the passengers, for sure."
"For the world," Vaughn said.
They passed the MP base just before 6:15. Neat, quiet, still. 6 parked Humvees, 4 guys in the guard shack, all in order and recently resupplied. For what? They slowed for the last 5 miles and tried to time it right. Traffic had died away to nothing. The plant was closed. The lights were off. Presumably, the last stragglers were heading home, to the east. Presumably, the Tahoes were parked for the night. Vaughn made the left onto Despair's old road, and then found the ruts in the gathering gloom and followed them like she had the night before, through the throat of the figure eight, and all the way to the spot behind the airplane barn. She parked there and went to pull the key, but Reacher put his hand on her wrist and said, "I have to do this part alone." Vaughn said,
"Why?"
"Because this has to be face to face, and the whole deal here is that you're permanent and I'm not. You're a cop from the next town, with a lot of years ahead of you. You can't go trespassing and breaking and entering all over the neighborhood."
"I already have."
"But nobody knew, which made it okay. This time it won't be okay."
"You're shutting me out?"
"Wait on the road. Any hassle, take off for home. I'll make my own way back." He left the ladder and the wrecking bar and the flashlight where they were, in the car. But he took the captured switchblades with him. He put one in each pocket, just in case. Then he hiked the 50 yards through the scrub and climbed the field stone wall. Chapter 58. It was still too light to make any sense out of hiding. Reacher just leaned against the barn's board wall near the front corner, outside, on the blind side, away from the house. He could smell the plane. Cold metal, oil, unburned hydrocarbons from the tanks. The clock in his head showed 1 minute before 7 in the evening. He heard footsteps at 1 minute past. Long strides, a heavy tread. The big guy from the plant, hustling. Lights came on in the barn. A bright rectangle of glare spilled forward, shadowed with wings and propeller blades. Then nothing, for 2 minutes. Then more footsteps, slower, a shorter stride. An older man with good shoes, overweight, battling stiffness and limping with joint pain. Reacher took a breath and stepped around the corner of the barn into the light. The big guy from the plant was standing behind the piper's wing, just waiting like some kind of a servant or a butler. Thurman was on the path leading from the house. He was dressed in his wool suit. He was wearing a white shirt and a blue tie. He was carrying a small cardboard carton. The carton was about the size of a six-pack of beer. There was no writing on it. The top flaps were folded shut one under the other. It wasn't heavy. Thurman was carrying it two-handed, out in front of his body, reverentially, but without strain. He stopped dead on the path, but didn't speak. Reacher watched him try to find something to say, and then watched him give up. So he filled the silence himself. He said, "Good evening, folks." Thurman said,
"You told me you were leaving."
"I changed my mind."
"You're trespassing."
"Probably."
"You need to leave now."
"I've heard that before."
"I meant it before, and I mean it now."
"I'll leave when I've seen what's in that box."
"Why do you want to know?"
"Because I'm curious about what part of Uncle Sam's property you're smuggling out of here every night." The big guy from the plant squeezed around the tip of the piper's wing and stepped out of the barn and put himself between Reacher and Thurman, closer to Thurman than Reacher. 2 against 1, explicitly. Thurman looked beyond the big guy's shoulder directly at Reacher and said,
"You're intruding."
Which struck Reacher as an odd choice of word. Interfering? Trespassing? Butting in, he would have expected.
"Intruding on what?"
The big guy asked his boss,
"You want me to throw him out?"
Reacher saw Thurman thinking about his answer. There was debate in his face. some kind of a long-range calculus that went far beyond the possible positive or negative outcome of a 2-minute brawl in front of an airplane hangar. Like the old guy was playing a long game and thinking 8 moves ahead. Reacher said, "What's in the box?" The big guy said, "Shall I get rid of him?" Thurman said,
"No, let him stay."
Reacher said, "What's in the box?" Thurman said,
"Not Uncle Sam's property. God's property."
"God brings you metal?"
"Not metal."
Thurman stood still for a second. Then he stepped around his underling, still carrying the box two-handed out in front of him, like a wise man bearing a gift. He knelt and laid it at Reacher's feet, and then stood up and backed away again. Reacher looked down. Theoretically, the box might be booby-trapped, or he might get hit on the head while he crouched down next to it. But he felt either thing was unlikely. The instructors at Rucker had said, "Be skeptical, but not too skeptical." Too much skepticism led to paranoia and paralysis. Reacher knelt next to the box, unlaced the crisscrossed flaps, raised them. The box held crumpled newspaper with a small plastic jar nested in it. The jar was a standard medical item, sterile, almost clear, with a screw lid. A sample jar, for urine or other bodily fluids. Reacher had seen many of them. The jar was a quarter full with black powder. The powder was coarser than talc, finer than salt. Reacher asked, "What is it?" Thurman said,
"Ash."
"From where?"
"Come with me and find out."
"Come with you."
"Fly with me tonight. I have nothing to hide, and I'm a patient man. I don't mind proving my innocence. Over and over and over again if I have to."
The big guy helped Thurman up onto the wing and watched as he folded himself in through the small door. Then he passed the box up. Thurman took it and laid it on a rear seat. The big guy stood back and let Reacher climb up by himself. Reacher ducked low and led with his legs and made it into the co-pilot's seat. He slammed the door and squirmed around until he was as comfortable as he was ever going to get, and then he buckled his harness. Beside him, Thurman buckled his and hit a bunch of switches. Dials lit up, and pumps whirred, and the whole airframe tensed and hummed. Then Thurman hit the starter button, and the exhaust coughed, and the propeller blade jerked around a quarter of the way, and then the engine caught with a roar, and the props spun up, and the cabin filled with loud noise and furious vibration. The plane lurched forward, uncertain, earthbound, darting slightly left and right. It waddled forward out of the hangar. Dust blew up all over the place. The plane moved on, down the taxiway, the prop turning fast, the wheels turning slow. Reacher watched Thurman's hands. He was operating the controls the same way an old guy drives a car, leaning back in his seat, casual, familiar, automatic, using the kind of short, abbreviated movements born of long habit. The taxiway led through 2 clumsy turns to the north end of the runway. The lights were on. Thurman got centered on the graded strip and hit the power, and the vibration leached forward out of the cabin into the engine, and the wheels started thumping faster below. Reacher turned and saw the cardboard carton slide backward on the seat and nestle against the back cushion. He glanced ahead and saw lit dirt below and rushing darkness above. Then the plane went light and the nose lifted. The plane clawed its way into the night sky and climbed and turned, and Reacher looked down and saw first the runway lights go off and then the hangar lights. Without them, there was little to see. The wall around the metal plant was faintly visible, a huge white rectangle in the gloaming. The plane climbed hard for a minute and then leveled off, and Reacher was dumped forward in his seat against his harness straps. He looked over at the dash and saw the altimeter reading 2,000 feet. Airspeed was a little over 120. The compass reading was southeast. Fuel was more than half full. Trim was good. The artificial horizon was level. There were plenty of green lights and no reds. Thurman saw him checking and asked,
"Are you afraid of flying, Mr. Reacher?"
Reacher said, "No." The engine was loud, and the vibration was setting up a lot of buzzes and rattles. Wind was howling around the screens and whistling in through cracks. Altogether, the little piper reminded Reacher of the kind of old cars people used as taxis at suburban railroad stations, sagging, worn out, clunky, but capable of making it through the ride. "Maybe," he asked. "Where are we going?"
"You'll see."
Reacher watched the compass. It was holding steady on south and east. There was an LED window below the compass with two green numbers showing, a GPS readout, latitude and longitude. They were below the 40th parallel and more than 100 degrees west. Both numbers were ticking downward, slowly and in step, south and east, at a modest speed. He called up maps in his mind. Empty land ahead, the corner of Colorado, the corner of Kansas, the Oklahoma panhandle. Then the compass swung a little farther south, and Reacher realized that Thurman had been skirting the airspace around Colorado Springs, an Air Force town, probably a little trigger-happy. Better to give it a wide berth. Thurman kept the height at 2,000 feet and the speed at 100 and a quarter, and the compass stayed a little south of southeast. Reacher consulted his mental maps again and figured that if they didn't land or change course, they were going to exit Colorado just left of the state's bottom right-hand corner. The time readout on the dash showed 7:17 in the evening, which was 2 minutes fast. Reacher thought about Vaughn, alone in her car. She would have heard the plane take off. She would be wondering why he hadn't come back over the wall. Thurman said,
"You broke into a container last night."
Reacher said, "Did I?"
"It's a fair guess. Who else would have?"
Reacher said nothing.
Thurman said, "You saw the cars."
"Did I?"
"Let's assume so. Like intelligent men."
"Why did they bring them to you?"
"There are some things any government feels it politic to conceal."
"What do you do with them?"
"The same thing we do with the wrecks towed off I-70. We recycle them." "Steel is a wonderful thing, Mr. Reacher. It goes around and around. Peugeots and Toyotas from the Gulf might once have been Fords and Chevrolets from Detroit, and they in turn might once have been Rolls-Royces from England or Holdens from Australia, or bicycles, or refrigerators. Some steel is new, of course, but surprisingly little of it. Recycling is where the action is."
"And the bottom line?"
"Naturally."
"So why don't you buy yourself a better plane?"
"You don't like this one?"
"Not much," Reacher said. They flew on. There was nothing but darkness ahead, relieved occasionally by tiny clusters of yellow light far below. Hamlets, farms, gas stations. At one point, Reacher saw brighter lights in the distance to the left and the right. Lamar, probably, and La Junta. Small towns, made larger by comparison with the emptiness all around them. Sometimes cars were visible on roads, tiny cones of blue light crawling slowly. Reacher asked, "How is Underwood doing, the deputy?" Thurman paused a moment. Then he said,
"He passed on."
"In the hospital?"
"Before we could get him there."
"Will there be an autopsy?"
He has no next of kin to request one.
Did you call the coroner?
No need. He was old. He got sick. He died.
He was about 40.
Ashes to ashes, dust to dust. It's in store for all of us.
You don't sound very concerned.
A good Christian has nothing to fear in death. And I own a town, Mr. Reacher. I see births and deaths all the time. One door closes, another opens.
Thurman leaned back, his gut between him and the stick, his hands held low. The engine held fast on a mid-range roar, and the whole plane shivered with vibration and bucked occasionally on rough air. The latitude number counted down slowly, and the longitude number slower still. Reacher closed his eyes. Flight time to the state line would be about 70 or 80 minutes. He figured they weren't going to land in Colorado itself. There wasn't much left of it, just empty grassland. He figured they were going to Oklahoma or Texas. They flew on. The air got steadily worse. Reacher opened his eyes. Downdrafts dropped them into troughs like a stone. Then updrafts hurled them back up again. They were sideswiped by gusts of wind. Not like in a big commercial Boeing. No juddering vibration and bouncing wings, no implacable forward motion, just violent physical displacement, like a pinball caught between bumpers. There was no storm outside, no rain, no lightning, no thunderheads, just roiling evening thermals coming up off the plains in giant waves, invisible, compressing, decompressing, making solid walls and empty voids. Thurman held the stick loosely and let the plane buck and dive. Reacher moved in his seat and smoothed the harness straps over his shoulders. Thurman said,
"You are afraid of flying."
"Flying is fine. Crashing is another story."
"An old joke."
"For a reason."
Thurman started jerking the stick and hammering the rudder. The plane rose and fell sharply and smashed from side to side. At first, Reacher thought they were seeking smoother air. Then he realized Thurman was deliberately making things worse. He was diving where the downdrafts were sucking anyway, and climbing with the updrafts. He was turning into the sidewinds and taking them like roundhouse punches. The plane was hammering all over the sky. It was being tossed around like the insignificant piece of junk it was. Thurman said, "This is why you need to get your life in order. The end could come at any time. Maybe sooner than you expect."
Reacher said nothing.
"I could end it for you now. I could roll and stall and power dive. 2,000 feet, we'd hit the deck at 300 miles an hour. The wings would come off first. The crater would be 10 feet deep."
"Go right ahead."
"You mean that?"
"I dare you."
An updraft hit, and the plane was thrown upward, and then the decompression wave came in, and the lift under the wings dropped away to a negative value, and the plane fell again. Thurman dropped the nose and hit the throttle, and the engine screamed, and the Piper tilted into a 45-degree power dive. The artificial horizon on the dash lit up red, and a warning siren sounded. It was barely audible over the scream of the engine and the battering airflow. Then Thurman pulled out of the dive. He jerked the nose up. The airframe groaned as the main spar stressed, and the plane curved level and then rose again through air that was momentarily calmer. Reacher said,
"Chicken."
Thurman said, "I have nothing to fear."
"So why pull out?"
"When I die, I'm going to a better place."
"I thought the big guy got to make that decision, not you."
"I've been a faithful servant."
"So go for it. Go to a better place right now. I dare you.
Reacher said nothing. Thurman flew on, straight and level, through air that was calming down. 2,000 feet, 125 knots, south of southeast.
Chicken, Reacher said again.
Phony. Thurman said, God wants me to complete my task.
What? He told you that in the last 2 minutes?
I think you're an atheist.
We're all atheists. You don't believe in Zeus or Thor or Neptune or Augustus Caesar or Mars or Venus or Sun Ra. You reject 1,000 gods. Why should it bother you if someone else rejects 1,001?
Thurman didn't answer.
Just remember, it was you who was afraid to die, not me.
They flew on 20 more minutes. The air went still and quiet. Reacher closed his eyes again. Then, dead on, 1.25 hours total elapsed time, Thurman moved in his seat. Reacher opened his eyes. Thurman hit a couple of switches and fired up his radio and held the stick with his knees and clamped a headset over his ears. The headset had a microphone on a boom that came off the left-hand earpiece. Thurman flicked it with his fingernail and said, It's me, on approach. Reacher heard a muffled, crackling reply and far below in the distance saw lights come on. Red and white runway lights, he assumed. But they were so far away they looked like a tiny pink pinpoint. Thurman started a long, slow descent. Not very smooth. The plane was too small and light for finesse. It jerked and dropped and leveled and dropped again. Laterally, it was nervous. It darted left, darted right. The pink pinpoint jumped around below them and drew closer and resolved into twin lines of red and white. The lines looked short. The plane wobbled and stumbled in the air and dipped low, and then settled on a shallow path all the way down. The runway lights rushed up to meet it and started blurring past left and right. For a second, Reacher thought Thurman had left it too late. But then the wheels touched down and bounced once and settled back, and Thurman cut the power and the plane rolled to a walk with half the runway still ahead of it. The engine note changed to a deep roar, and the walk picked up to taxiing speed, and Thurman jerked left off the runway and drove 100 yards to a deserted apron. Reacher could see the vague outlines of brick buildings in the middle distance. He saw a vehicle approaching, headlights on, big, dark, bulky. A Humvee. Camouflage paint. The Humvee parked 20 feet from the Piper, and the doors opened and 2 guys climbed out. Battle dress uniform. Woodland pattern. Soldiers. Chapter 59. Reacher sat for a moment in the sudden silence with his ears ringing, and then he opened the Piper's door and climbed out to the wing. Thurman passed him the cardboard carton. Reacher took it one-handed and slid down to the tarmac. The 2 soldiers snapped to attention and threw salutes and stood there like a ceremonial detail, expectantly. Thurman climbed down behind Reacher and took the box from him. 1 of the soldiers stepped forward. Thurman bowed slightly and offered the box. The soldier bowed slightly and took it and turned on his heel and slow marched back to the Humvee. His partner fell in behind him, line astern. Thurman followed them. Reacher followed Thurman. The soldiers stowed the box in the Humvee's load bed and then climbed in the front. Reacher and Thurman got in the back. Big vehicle, small seats, well separated by the massive transmission tunnel, a diesel engine. They turned a tight circle on the apron and drove toward a building that stood alone in a patch of lawn. Lights were on in 2 ground-floor windows. The Humvee parked, and the soldiers retrieved the box from the load bed and slow marched it into the building. 1 minute later, they came back out again without it.
Thurman said.
Job done. For tonight, at least.
What was in the jar?
People, Thurman said. Men? Maybe women. We scrape them off the metal. When there's been a fire, that's all that's left of them. Soot, baked onto steel. We scrape it off and collect it in twists of paper, and then we put the day's gleanings into jars. It's as close as we can get to giving them a proper burial.
Where are we?
Fort Shaw, Oklahoma, up in the Panhandle. They deal with recovered remains here, among other things. They're associated with the Identification Laboratory in Hawaii.
You come here every night?
As often as necessary, which is most nights, sadly.
What happens now?
They give me dinner and they gas up my plane. The soldiers climbed back into the front seats, and the Humvee turned again and drove 100 yards to the main cluster of buildings. A 50s Army base, one of thousands in the world. Brick, green paint, whitewashed curbs, swept blacktop. Reacher had never been there before, had never even heard of it. The Humvee parked by a side door that had a sign that said it led to the officers' club. Thurman turned to Reacher and said,
I won't ask you to join me for dinner. They'll have set just one place, and it would embarrass them.
Reacher nodded. He knew how to find food on post. Probably better food than Thurman would be eating in the O Club.
I'll be okay, and thanks for asking.
Thurman climbed out and disappeared through the O Club door. The grunts in the front of the Humvee craned around, unsure about what to do next. They were both privates first class, probably stationed permanently in the States. Maybe they had a little Germany time under their belts, but nothing else of significance. No Korea time. No desert time, certainly. They didn't have the look.
Reacher said, Remember wearing diapers when you were 2 years old?
The driver said,
Sir, not specifically, sir.
Back then I was a major in the MPs, so I'm going to take a stroll now, and you don't need to worry about it. If you want to worry about it, I'll dig out your CO and we'll do the brother officer thing, and he'll okay it, and you'll look stupid. How does that sound?
The guy wasn't totally derelict, not totally dumb. He asked,
Sir, what unit and where?
Reacher said, 110th MP. HQ was in Rock Creek, Virginia.
The guy nodded.
It still is. The 110th is still in business.
I certainly hope so.
Sir, you have a pleasant evening. Chow in the mess until 10 if you're interested.
Thanks, soldier, Reacher said.
He climbed out, and the Humvee drove away and left him. He stood still for a moment in the sharp night air, and then set out walking to the standalone building. Its original purpose was unclear to him. No reason to have a physically separated building unless it held infectious patients or explosives, and it didn't look like either a hospital or an armory. Hospitals were bigger, and armories were stronger. He went in the front door and found himself in a small, square hallway with stairs ahead of him and doors either side. The upstairs windows had been dark. The lit windows had been on the ground floor. If in doubt, turn left, was his motto. So he tried the left-hand door and came up empty. An administrative office. Lights blazing. Nobody in it. He stepped back to the hallway and tried the right-hand door. Found a medic with the rank of captain at a desk, with Thurman's jar in front of him. The guy was young for a captain, but medics got promoted fast. They were usually 2 steps ahead of everyone else. Help you? The guy said.
I flew in with Thurman. I was curious about his jar.
Curious how?
Is it what he says it is?
Are you authorized to know?
I used to be. I was an MP. I did some forensic medicine with Nash Newman, who was probably your ultimate boss back when you were a second lieutenant, unless he had retired already. He's probably retired now. The guy nodded.
He is retired now, but I heard of him.
So are there human remains in the jar?
Probably.
Almost certainly, in fact. Carbon?
No carbon, the guy said.
In a hot fire, all the carbon is driven off as carbon dioxide. What's left of a person after cremation are oxides of potassium, sodium, iron, calcium, maybe a little magnesium, all inorganic. And that's what's in the jar. The guy nodded again. Entirely consistent with burned human flesh and bone.
What do you do with it?
We send it to the Central Identification Laboratory in Hawaii.
And what do they do with it?
Nothing.
There's no DNA in it. It's just soot, basically. The whole thing is an embarrassment, really. But Thurman keeps on showing up. He's a sentimental old guy. We can't turn him away, obviously. So we stage a sweet little ceremony and accept whatever he brings. Can't trash it afterward, either. Wouldn't be respectful. So we move it off our desks onto Hawaii's. I imagine they stick it in a closet and forget all about it.
I'm sure they do.
Does Thurman tell you where it comes from?
Iraq, obviously.
But what kind of vehicles?
Does it matter?
I would say so.
We don't get those details.
Reacher asked, what was this building originally?
A VD clinic,
the medic said. You got a phone I could use? The guy pointed to a console on his desk.
Have at it.
Reacher dialed 411 upside down and got the number for David Robert Vaughn, 5th Street, Hope, Colorado. He said the number once under his breath to memorize it and then dialed it. No answer. He put the phone back in the cradle and asked,
"Where's the mess?"
"Follow your nose," the medic said, which was good advice.
Reacher walked back to the main cluster and circled until he smelled the aroma of fried food coming out of a powerful extraction vent. The vent came through the wall of a low, lean-to addition to a larger, square, one-story building. The mess kitchen and the mess. Reacher went in and got a few questioning looks, but no direct challenges. He got in line and picked up a cheeseburger the size of a softball, plus fries, plus beans, plus a mug of coffee. The burger was excellent, which was normal for the Army. Mess cooks were in savage competition to produce the best patty. The coffee was excellent, too. A unique, standardized blend, in Reacher's opinion, the best in the world. He had been drinking it all his life. The fries were fair, and the beans were adequate. All in all, probably better than the limp piece of grilled fish the officers were getting. He took more coffee and sat in an armchair and read the Army papers. He figured the two PFCs would come get him when Thurman was ready to leave. They would drive their guests out to the flight line and salute smartly and finish their little show in style just after midnight. Taxiing, takeoff, the climb, then 90 minutes in the air. That would get them back to despair by 2, which seemed to be the normal schedule. 3 hours worth of free aviation fuel, plus a free 4-hour dinner. Not bad, in exchange for a quarter full jar of soot. A born-again Christian American and a businessman was how Thurman had described himself. Whatever kind of a Christian he was a useful businessman, that was for damn sure. The mess kitchen closed. Reacher finished the papers and dozed. The PFCs never showed. At 12:10 in the morning, Reacher woke up and heard the Piper's engine in the distance, and by the time the sound registered in his mind, it was revving hard. By the time he made it outside, the little white plane was on the runway. He stood and watched as it lifted off and disappeared into the darkness above. Chapter 60. The Humvee came back from the flight line, and the two PFCs got out and nodded to Reacher like nothing was wrong. Reacher said, "I was supposed to be on that plane." The driver said,
"No, sir. Mr. Thurman told us you had a one-way ticket tonight. He told us you were heading south from here on business of your own. He told us you were all done in Colorado."
Reacher said, "Shit." He thought back to Thurman in front of the airplane barn, the deliberate pause, debate in his face, some kind of a long-range calculus, like he was playing a long game, thinking 8 moves ahead. "Fly with me tonight. I won't ask you to join me for dinner." Reacher shook his head. He was 90 minutes flying time from where he needed to be, in the middle of the night, in the middle of nowhere, with no airplane, outwitted by a 70-year-old preacher. Dumb and tense. I think they were all stirred up because they're heading for the end of something. What? He had no idea. When? He had no clue. He checked the map in his head. There were no highways in the Oklahoma Panhandle. None at all. Just a thin, red tracery of state 4 lanes and county 2 lanes. He glanced at the Humvee and at the PFCs and said, "You guys want to drive me out to a road?"
"Which road?"
"Any road that gets traffic more than once an hour."
"You could try 287 that goes south."
"I need to go north, back to Colorado. Thurman wasn't entirely frank with you."
287 goes north, too, all the way up to I-70.
"How far is that?"
"Sir, I believe it's dead on 200 miles.
Hitchhiking had gotten more and more difficult in the 10 years since Reacher left the Army. Drivers were less generous, more afraid. The West was sometimes better than the East, which helped. Day was always better than night, which didn't. The Humvee from Fort Shaw let him out at 12:45, and it was a 1:15 in the morning before he saw his first northbound vehicle, a Ford F-150 that didn't even slow down to take a look. It just blew past. 10 minutes later, an old Chevy Blazer did the same thing. Reacher blamed the movies. They made people scared of strangers. Although in reality, most movies had the passing strangers messed up by the locals, not the other way around. Weird, inbred families that hunted people for sport. But mostly Reacher blamed himself. He knew he was no kind of an attractive roadside proposition. "Look at yourself. What do you see?" Maria from San Diego was the kind of person that got rides easily. Sweet, small, unthreatening, needy. Vaughn would do okay, too. Hulks 6'5" in height were a riskier bet. At 2:10, a dark Toyota pickup at least slowed and took a look before passing by, which was progress of a sort. 2:05, a 20-year-old Cadillac swept past. It had an out-of-tune motor and a collapsed rear suspension, and an old woman low down behind the wheel. White hair, thin neck, what Reacher privately called a Q-tip. Not a likely prospect. Then at 2:15, an old Suburban heaved into view. In Reacher's experience, new Suburbans were driven by uptight assholes, but old models were plain utilitarian vehicles, often driven by plain utilitarian people. Their bulk often implied a kind of no-nonsense self-confidence on the part of their owners, a kind of self-confidence that said strangers weren't necessarily a problem. The best hope, so far. Reacher stepped off the shoulder and put one foot in the traffic lane, cocked his thumb in a way that suggested need but not desperation. The Suburban's brights came on. It slowed. It stopped altogether 15 feet short of where Reacher was standing. A smart move. It gave the guy behind the wheel a chance to look over his potential passenger without the kind of social pressure that face-to-face proximity would imply. Reacher couldn't see the driver, too much dazzle from the headlights. A decision was made.